This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello, I'm Sheila Dillon, and welcome to this BBC download of the Food Programme. For information on the BBC's terms and conditions of use, visit www.bbc.co.uk/radio4. And now, enjoy the podcast. 10 years ago, I went to Sweden to look at a school meal service that was widely praised for the quality of the school dinners. But politicians had been manoeuvring to make cuts until, a few days before my visit, the first episode of Jamie's School Dinners, exposing some of our worst horrors, was beamed out on Swedish television.
I went to primary school and held up 30 vegetables, right, of which they only knew about five. Incredible. You know, I held up a rhubarb and someone thought it was a potato.
Suddenly, school food was on Sweden's political agenda, and the media was ravenous. Posses of them followed us everywhere, because they'd been told we knew Jamie. I felt like the modern version of the girl who danced with the man, who danced with the girl, who danced with the Prince of Wales.
What do you think your Jamie Oliver would say if he saw this?
I think Jamie Oliver would be pretty cheered up by the whole system in Malmö. It's seriously impressive, I think.
A decade later, there's been a school food revolution in the UK. Not everywhere, and not yet to Jamie's highest standards, but the understanding that school meals matter has gone deep.
So, Jamie, you may not be a mechanic, but you've been able to change those mechanics. How did you do it? Just tell us all how we can go out and do it just the way you did.
Right, where do I start?
An Englishman being asked at an international gathering, there it was in Turin, for advice on school meals, how the world turns. Today's programme is about that change. Where are the radical ideas coming from? Well, we've followed this story for a long time. So what we're doing today is writing our school food report, 2015. First, a chef you might remember, our cook of the year in 2014's Food and Farming Awards. Catering manager at Ravenscliffe High School in Halifax.
The winner this year is Tony Mulgrew.
Good produce, local suppliers, getting that into schools is so important. So, yeah, just push and drive.
When we talked to Tony at the start of the year, we were impressed to hear he was following up on those plans. An explosion in Twitter followers post-awards led to one special relationship.
A chef in Sweden and myself have been following each other on Twitter, and both of us working in schools, passionate about what we do. We've arranged an exchange visit.
So we followed Tony on his voyage into Swedish school cuisine. Local reporter Kalle Vanerskog picks up the story.
I'm standing outside of the high school of Gislaved. Gislaved is a small town in the western parts of Sweden, about 1.5 hours with a car from Gothenburg. The reason I'm standing here is that Tony Mulgrew is here visiting the local school chef, a guy called Lyndon MacLeod, who originally comes from New Zealand.
Good morning. I'm just breading up some fresh haddock. We've got polenta with dill and parsley. One of the interesting things that I noticed with Twitter and Lyndon was the different variations of fish sauces and breadcrumbs and what have you. So through the exchange, I wanted to pick up all these different recipes and ideas.
Do you think that the kids here enjoy fish more than the kids in England?
Well, it's certainly on the menu more often.
Now, Lyndon and Tony are emptying all the grease.
I just know we're shallow frying the fish that Tony's crumbed.
When you visited the UK and Tony's kitchen a couple of weeks ago, have you had an experience there that you took back to Sweden?
What I learned most about was how we can buy local food so easily. You buy from a local organic farm. He rings to the farmer and he orders what he needs, or the farmer rings to him and say, look, Tony, I've got some pork here over. Coming next week, where can you buy it? And he's like, yeah.
You don't have it for your morale?
No, we don't have it here in Sweden. You're all locked up with the EU rules and procurement.
Because driving here, I saw a lot of farms on the road here that had big signs that said meat from this yard, and maybe organic and for sure local, but you're not able to use any.
No, I'm not able to use any at all. It's disappointing, really, because you want to buy local food so you can stimulate the market here. There'll be more jobs. It would be great for everybody.
I've just had a message from one of my local farmers giving me today's prices on the pork that she can supply. Leg of pork, boned and rolled, $3.75 per kilo. I don't think she realizes I'm in Sweden, so.
Lyndon, when you hear about that text message he just got, how do you feel?
Oh, I'm a bit jealous, actually.
For every £1 that we're spending in the local community, it's generating at least £2 to £3. So it's beneficial for everyone.
What is the purpose of this exchange?
One of the main ideas behind this exchange is setting up the Good Field Project, which Lyndon has put a Facebook page together, where chefs and cooks, if they have problems within their own kitchens, wherever they are in the world, another cook or chef would be able to give them some support with an answer.
So we just got a sample of haddock.
The sauce is like a remoulade sauce here in Sweden, with parsley and dill, mayonnaise, lemons.
Really, really cooked to perfection. The sauce is nice and light and fresh.
The color is beautiful too. The yellow crust. It's my turn.
What?
Perfect cooked fish.
The effects for me within my own school, we've got fish on the menu, but I've tried to introduce it twice a week now. Through social media, such as Twitter and Facebook, you can build up these relationships. Myself and Lyndon were constantly tweeting and sharing photographs, so more and more people can see what we're trying to achieve. Food's food, and it's one of those things that brings everyone together.
School chef Tony Mulgrew. Well, I'm in a studio, and I've been looking at pictures online of school lunches from around the world, with two people at the heart of the school food revolution in the UK. Jeanette Ory, who's been doing school food way longer than Jamie. In fact, it was she who inspired Jamie. She met him at the BBC Food and Farming Awards, and the rest is history. She now advises governments and got her MBE in 2012. And Henry Dimbleby, co-founder of the healthy fast food chain Leon and co-author with John Vincent of the School Food Plan, set up with the support of the coalition government, now supported by all political parties, to carry on the revolution that Jamie and Jeanette started. Henry, Sweden was one of the countries that you and John looked at when you were writing the School Food Plan. What did you make of what you found out?
What's wonderful about the exchange to Sweden is that is now, I think, more and more what's happening. In the UK, people are going to other schools. They didn't used to go to other schools and look at the food and learning from people who've worked out how to do this. You can't pass a law to make people cook good food that children like. People are coming to learn from us. So Poland are thinking of introducing food-based standards based on the model that we've introduced here. We've had researchers recently from the Netherlands, from Japan, from Bulgaria, all coming to the UK to see what we're doing. We are doing some pretty amazing stuff in some schools, but there are still too many schools where the food is beige and bland and boring, and we can do better.
Jeanette, I mean, you've recently been involved in writing this European report on school food in Italy, UK, Denmark and Sweden. You know, you were being asked for advice by Italians. I mean, did that ever seem likely?
No, because we were always told, you know, we were so far behind. To be asked to be part of this Food for Thought programme and to go and visit those countries and see what they were doing, actually to walk away and saying, I think we're doing better. It was
better
just...
Better than in Rome?
Better than in Rome.
But Henry's just made the point that, you know, there's far too much bland beige food.
I personally don't think it is. You know, we are seeing it disappear, albeit slowly, but it is going.
People who are worried about their schools, go and see the food in your school. Ask to see it, your children's food. And if it's not good enough, ask the head teacher what they're going to do about it.
But of course, that brings up that we're on the brink of an election. The school food plan comes to an end on election day.
John and I's responsibilities end on election day, but the government has funded money for the school food plan office to continue going.
But I think the question in a lot of people's minds will be, can we go backwards on this? You know, there's a big push to cut social spending. You know, it's an easy thing to say, well, school meals don't matter.
Who would have thought that 15 years ago that we would still be talking about school meals 15 years later? You know, we've got this tanker, we're turning it round, it's nearly there, maybe another 5 years, so just as I retire, hopefully, we will be there.
Do you think that's right?
Well, I think there are two things that require government support. Universal free school meals clearly requires government support. The other thing is small schools, which require, because of the economics, and more funding. But mostly, it's not actually about money. And people don't like to hear this, but it's not about money. My sons go to a state primary in Hackney, and the head chef has just started there. Used to be the head chef at Ottolenghi's Nopi restaurant, a very smart restaurant in London. Looking at her menu here, you know, we've got, on Tuesday, we're having chicken in soy and pumpkin, Jersey Royals, grilled lettuce and peas. You know, it's watercress, pumpkin and pomegranate salad. It's good stuff. But she has got the cost per dish down from 93p to about 78p because there's much less waste. She's standing by the bins, seeing what the kids like, seeing what they're eating, seeing what they're not eating. It's not about money. It's about skills and leadership.
But isn't that held back still by the fact that school dinner ladies, and they still are mostly ladies, still get absolutely rock bottom wages?
Yes, we have asked the catering teams to rise to the challenge of universal infant free school meals, of cooking from fresh, of having small kitchens, and they've risen to that challenge. But what have they got in the process? Not a lot.
I mean, Henry, have you had to come up with some subsidy to pay your chef, Nicole Pisani? I mean, she's not getting £8 an hour, is she?
Well, in Hackney, they pay the living wage anyway, and Nicole is actually being paid only slightly less than she was being paid. She's being paid for the chef's job and also because being a professional chef, unless you're a named chef, is not a particularly well-paid career.
You're a governor of your son's school. You think it's not a specially privileged school that's been able to attract Nicole? It's something that anyone could do anywhere.
There are other chefs doing it elsewhere, and we're hoping that we can take this model and we can roll it out. I think it's essential that the two worlds of school cooks and cooks in general are fused, that they're not two completely separate professions.
The system has had to absorb all kinds of pressures. I mean, everyone seems to be agreed that universal free meals for infants is a terrific development. But what has that meant for dinner ladies, Jeanette?
It's meant, in a lot of cases, huge stress, with kitchens not being maybe large enough, with all of a sudden going from 150 to 300 a day. The staff haven't increased, the hours haven't increased. Not in all cases, I'm going to add. But for instance, I mean, a friend of mine, absolutely fabulous, went up by 100 meals a day. She's actually left the industry. She had a nervous breakdown. It's a responsibility that we all feel as well, I think. Obviously, we want to do a good job.
But it brings us back to what Henry was saying, that the more public catering and, you know, the chefery worlds come together, the less likely that is to happen.
Mm, the better, I
Faster
hope.
The better.
Mm.
Well, yes. Let's go to another model, another Scandinavian country, Denmark, to Copenhagen, where, as Dan Saladino discovered, they've been going through some dramatic changes.
A three-storey building a few minutes' walk from Copenhagen Central Station seems an unlikely setting for a school food revolution.
We are here in the area of the meat park district, you know, where you take all the meat in. It's also a district of red light.
But in 2007, a converted office building in the meatpacking district became the HQ in the mission to transform public food in Copenhagen. It all started when a public outcry over poor quality school food became a serious political issue.
My name is Anne Birgitte. I'm a director of this Copenhagen food house.
There was a situation where the mayor ate a school meal.
Yeah, and they don't like it. And when they find out they don't want to serve this for the children, they ask us to help change the school food.
And that was going to be a huge challenge, bigger than the one that faced schools in the UK at the same time. Where it was provided, food in Copenhagen's schools was so poor, take-up was just 2%. There were very few purpose-built school kitchens and dining areas, and the quality of packed lunches being eaten in a 15-minute break were also causing concern.
The parents in the evening, you know, make the food in plastic, give the children, and then we eat it in the classroom. So it's no food culture. It's terrible.
With few kitchens and dining rooms and little cooking expertise in schools, £10 million was spent creating the Copenhagen Food House, a building with the expertise and equipment to improve the 60,000 meals a day coming out of Copenhagen's 700 public kitchens.
If you go down here...
So we're going down into a cellar, and yeah, there you can feel the temperature increase.
That's because in this cellar is row after row of professional kitchens. This is where a new generation of school cooks is being trained.
Normally it will be 18 to 20 kitchen staff learn to make better food.
Cooks come here to be trained on 7-week courses, but more importantly, chefs from the Copenhagen Food House go out to work in schools.
I send people out and say, okay, now we make food together with the chefs and the children, and after 2 weeks they like it. Maybe the first 2 days they hate it. It's a different way we work.
And what the schools are being trained to cook is even more radical. By the end of this year, it's expected that 90% of the ingredients used in schools will be organic. No extra money is being given to make this happen, and the idea is that by setting this target, the entire approach to cooking in schools will change.
It make a little bit a kind of revolution in the kitchen, because they have to think in another way. They have to think in season because they have no money not to think in season. They have to think that they're not able to eat so much meat because they have no money to eat it. You have to throw out all the plastic food and make it by yourself. You have to find out how you don't waste food anymore.
So organic becomes a means to an end, not an end in itself.
No.
It's the mechanism by which
you make the changes.
Outside the building, more cooking is underway, this time with fire. The food house cooks are teaching a group of school children.
In the pot, like a Dutch oven, we're cooking some bread. The kids can eat everything. Everything you can't get them to eat inside, you can get them to eat outside.
One of the pupils is 13-year-old Sulfros Nielsen, a pupil at a school that represents what the food house is helping to create. It's one of 7 so-called food schools, where kitchens and dining areas have been built and factored into the school year. It's time for every pupil to do some serious work in the kitchen.
1 week a year, you come down in the kitchen and make food. Nothing else, just make food.
And you're feeding the other pupils in the school?
Yeah.
So far, the Copenhagen Food House has helped to increase the uptake of school meals from 2% to closer to 30%. And in the 7 food schools, it's now as high as 90%.
Dan Saladino reporting from Copenhagen's Food House. Well, Jeanette, you've been to the food house, and it's one of the projects you've been working with recently, as I said earlier, sharing knowledge across European cities. What did you make of the project?
The food schools were just absolutely brilliant. They had a waiting list of children wanting school lunches. Yes, Henry's going, whoa. The head teacher, who was phenomenal, she said that the kitchen was this size, the staff had got these many hours, and therefore this is the amount of lunches that they can produce, and no more.
Henry, you've been working with the Mayor of London.
This is actually based on a Finnish idea. So there are 2 boroughs in London, Croydon and Lambeth, where we are attempting to show that if you change not just the food education, the schools and the food served in the schools, but you change food served in hospitals. By changing everything in a small area, you can reduce obesity, not by 1% or 2%, but by 5%, 10%, 15%. A guy called Pekka Puska in Finland, where they had very bad rates of cardiovascular disease, they reduced the salt in the sausages, they gave people over the age of 60 snowshoes, and male life expectancy went up by 7 years. It was a massive change. I think that it's too simplistic just to think there'll be these food hubs and they will solve everything. The most interesting expression I thought that Pekka Puska used when he's. I said, "What's the key to success?" And he said, "You need to get your boots deep in the mud." And so, there's no one solution. It's a complicated problem.
I want to actually go back to these images we were looking at of dishes from around the world. Is it all useful to do this?
I can remember going off to Australia. In Western Australia, it was dreadful. It came in a laundry basket, and this is going back a few years, and then there was this bread, and it's called fairy bread. And it literally was white, cheap size white loaf, covered with margarine, and then you dunk it into hundreds and thousands.
Pure that was sugar. Lunch?
That was part of lunch. You know,
it makes turkey Twizzlers look quite good, yeah, actually.
Well, I thought
yeah.
it looked quite tame, actually, what we were up to. You know, it still really annoys me when they put a school lunch on a prison tray.
Prison trays.
We have plates.
I think we need to stop thinking about this idea that somehow all nations have homogeneously good or bad school food. There are great people doing great things around the corner from you that are potentially as good as anything that's going on in Sweden.
The last time we did school meals, we went to see Martha Payne, and you know, she was gathering on this young girl's blog these photographs from all over the world, and that was a sort of that moment where children became part of the discussion.
If you look at how social media is holding restaurants to account, you know, you find out very quickly now if a restaurant is good or a restaurant is bad. And I think that will happen. There'll be some kind of TripAdvisor site.
God, what a good idea for any tech proficient person who loves food. Get one started, Jeanette.
No, not while I'm still involved in school meals. I just really, really do not like a TripAdvisor school meals.
Why not?
Because I think it can be divisive. I think it can be dreadfully upsetting.
But maybe some people need to be upset.
Maybe some people do need to be upset, but not to that extent. I always think there are ways and means of saying to somebody, you know, maybe you could do it this way.
Well, to sum up, do you mind? I mean, this is an awful thing to say, but how far have we really come in 10 years, Jeanette? I mean, how do you measure it?
People probably remember me saying the cheesy feet. So all of the processed products to virtually every school I go into now, it's freshly prepared. To other countries coming over to see what we're doing. I mean, next week we've got Copenhagen, the House of Food, coming to see what's happening in nurseries, in hospitals, in other settings, not just schools. So I just cannot believe I pinch myself sometimes.
What about you, Henry? I mean, you've not been in this quite as long as Jeanette.
There is work to do in some schools. It's gone from bad to okay, and getting it from okay to good and good to great on the school food thing. But I think the biggest challenge that we now have as a country is on the education. When everyone in this country can cook five savoury dishes by the age of 16, that is when we will really have solved the problem with food-related diseases.
Did you also think the big change is that policymakers, politicians, actually have begun to grasp that cooking matters?
Our job was actually much easier than Jamie Oliver's. So when he got involved, it was seen almost by some people as a kind of wishy-washy, liberal-minded way of not thinking about maths and English. All politicians now understand that the problem, financial and societal, of food-related disease is in the top three problems that society faces. No one doesn't believe that anymore.
Go back, as I say, 15 years, when it all started, it was literally about the food on the plate. It is no longer about the food on the plate. It is about the whole school approach, which we said all those years ago, but nobody was listening at that time. Now they are.
Well, thank you both very much, Jeanette Orry and Henry Dimbleby. It's, as you've heard, a fast-changing picture. So, to help us understand it even better, we'd be very happy to hear from you. You can tweet us at @BBCFoodProg using the hashtag SchoolLunch. Now it's over to Dan Saladino for a food story from within the Arc of Taste.
In our journey through this catalogue of forgotten foods and ingredients at risk of extinction, this is possibly the smallest.
What I have is called a Sea Island red pea. Very, very small pea. Some people call them rice peas. If you look at the very, very middle, it looks like there's like a small grain of rice that's sitting there, but they literally are red peas.
And they capture one of the most important stories in American history. Matthew Rayford is a sixth-generation farmer from Georgia and grew up close to the chain of islands on the southeastern Atlantic coast, the Sea Islands, in the 17th century, a place of plantations and a destination for the red pea.
The peas were originally cultivated by the slaves that came from West Africa,
who introduced grains, pulses, and farming expertise.
When Africans were originally brought to the United States as slaves, they were originally brought for rice. And a lot of people think that it's King Cotton, and that's what most movies show. But it was primarily for rice originally, to cultivate rice.
A crop which is inextricably linked with the red pea. Both are important ingredients in so-called Gullah Geechee cooking, the food culture of the descendants of enslaved Africans that's still found in South Carolina, Georgia, and the Sea Islands. And there's a Gullah term for the dish that combined these two ingredients, rice and peas.
Where I'm from, it's called Reezy Peasy, and so it's Carolina gold rice and these red peas.
The pea is described as having bold flavours. It will have filled the iron pots left slowly cooking all day on plantations.
It tastes earthy. It tastes very, very earthy. And it's also very heavy bean. It's heavy. Like you have a full meal when you eat Sea Island red peas and rice.
And there was another reason the African slaves carried this prized source of food across the Atlantic Ocean. Owning these peas meant survival.
The pea itself likes the least fertile soil that it can find. I actually went over to the Sea Islands and actually sat down with like one of a few last few descendants from the original Geechee Gullah slaves that are there. And she was like, you just dig a hole and drop it in there and cover it. And I said, you don't put anything else? She says, no. And she said, and it'll grow. And I said, well, how much water? She said, I don't add any water either. Just let it grow.
Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children.
In the 1960s, the civil rights movement created new opportunities for black Americans. A less familiar change that took place involved food.
Well, part of it becoming lost was people moving away. A lot of people were trying to get away from the islands. You know, they were trying to create a better life for themselves, so to speak.
Farming still had connotations of slavery. In 1910, there were a million black farmers. In the US today, there are now only 18,000. With that decline, crops disappeared and flavors were lost.
As a kid, I was raised actually farming and always cooking. But when I grew up, my dad was like, no, we need to get you off the farm. You can do so much better than me. And not realizing that some of that has caused some deterioration and loss of some of the best products that we have. If no one keeps farming it, it eventually just becomes like seed that just sits somewhere.
For Matthew, all of that changed. 3 years ago, he returned to the farm. And in 2012, on a visit to Terra Madre, a slow food event that brings together these foods at risk of extinction, he walked past a display and noticed something familiar, the Sea Island red pea.
And so I walked into the booth and said, where did you all get these beans from? And they said, these beans are on the Ark of Taste. And I was like, these are the same beans I ate as a kid. And we couldn't find them because I hadn't seen them since I was a kid. And someone said, do you want these beans? And so the first crop of these beans were beans that I actually got from Ark of Taste. And now we're actually growing out these beans.
And from near extinction, the red pea is now being grown on 100 acres of land by Matthew and a small group of other farmers.
This pea means that there'll be a seventh generation to grow this pea on my farm, which is part of the history that comes out of Georgia. And so that, to me, is more important than anything else, is that we're able to preserve our history through food.
Matthew Rayford on bringing back a 300-year-old flavor.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.